Shalom and welcome to Radio Shalom. I'm Deb Levy, and today we're going to be looking at the Talmud. And we're going to be asking a few interesting questions, including what is the Talmud, why is it so important in Judaism, and interestingly, why is it one of the best-selling books in South Korea? So to start off with today, I think it's useful to look at what the Talmud is and where it's from. The Talmud is often referred to also as Gemara. The terms are used interchangeably, and they refer to a whole body of debates, discussions, parables, fables, stories, jurisprudence, and different ideas that were collected over debates that span generations between different rabbis. From a modern Orthodox Jewish perspective, the Talmud was given at Mount Sinai along with the rest of the Torah. And interestingly, while many people are familiar with the five books of Moses, the part of the Torah that is most commonly spread throughout the world, there are many people who don't know that in Jewish tradition, we actually consider the Torah to be much, much broader. It doesn't just cover the Tanakh, the writings and the prophets, the Torah, Nevi'im and Ketuvim. It also covers all of the debates, discussions and commentary that took place afterwards with the great Jewish sages. And so today we're going to have a chance to explore some of that work together and to look at what impact it's had on the Jewish people even until today. But before I get into that, I want to start with a well-known joke about Talmudic interpretation. There's a Jewish man who goes to see his rabbi and he says to him, "Rabbi, I want you to teach me the whole Talmud." The rabbi says to him, "Okay, but first I have a question for you." The man standing there listening. And the rabbi says to him, I'll give you a scenario and I want to know what you think. Two men go down a chimney and they come out the bottom and one has a clean face and the other has a sooty face. And I want to know which one do you think washes his face? And the man answers immediately, "Well, the one with the sooty face would wash his face. His face is dirty." The rabbi says, No. Think for a moment, because the one with the dirty face looks across at the one with the clean face and thinks his face is clean. And the one with the clean face looks across at the one with the dirty face and thinks his face is dirty. And so actually, the one who washes his face is the clean one." Says the man. "Okay, rabbi." The rabbi says, "I've got another question for you. Two men go down a chimney. One comes out with a clean face. The other comes out with a sooty face. Who washes their face?" The man's very happy. He knows the answer. He says, "The one with the clean face, rabbi." The rabbi says, No. Think about it. Because the one with the clean face also has a clean body. He looks down at himself, sees that he's not dirty, and he doesn't wash his face. The one with the dirty face looks down at his body, sees that it is covered in soot, and so he knows he has to wash his face." The man looks a little bit confused and says, Okay. And the rabbi says, "I have another question for you. Two men come down a chimney. One of them has a clean face. One of them has a dirty face." And the man is now completely confused. He says, "Look, rabbi, it could be either. You've explained both scenarios to me where it could be the one. I guess both could potentially wash their face." And the rabbi says to him, "No, what kind of a situation is this? In what world would two men go down a chimney and one come out with a clean face and one come out with a dirty face? It's an impossible situation." At this point, the man is completely exasperated. He turns to the rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, is this some kind of joke?" And the rabbi turns to him and says, "No, this is Talmud." And this is Talmud. In Talmud, there is no end to the questions, the debates, the discussion, the different scenarios. There is no stone left unturned. Much like the Torah, the five books of Moses, everything is presented warts and all. There are no perfect people. There are no perfect scenarios. Everything is explored in great detail. And there can be a debate that runs between grandparents and grandchildren across multiple generations. And what's really important is the minority opinions are always included and always considered. Today we have a chance to go through a bit of a Talmudic journey. We're going to look at some of the Talmudic stories. But before I begin that, I want to share with you a quote from Elie Wiesel, who was a passionate Talmud scholar. He loved delving into the Talmud. And if you go online, you can Google Elie Wiesel Talmud, and you'll come up with hundreds and hundreds of lectures from him about different characters from the Talmud, different parables and stories, different learnings. And I really believe that if this blurb, if this quote from Elie Wiesel was written on the back of every Talmud, then it would be a best-selling book, not just in South Korea, but all around the world. So listen to this. And pretend that I have the amazing presence and accent of Elie Wiesel. May he rest in peace. The Talmud is, after all, an entity. You plunge into its immensity like a wondrous universe where everything is a sign. Everything suggests a problem. No sooner have you answered one question when you must confront 10 others resulting from the answer. At first glance, the stories, the sayings, the references, the hints, the laws, the outbursts may seem confusing. They should not be. The Talmud is an edifice. Everything within its structure is connected. Every legend has its justification. Every word has its place. Once you have been grasped by its rhythm and its logic, the discipline of Talmudic thought, you will no longer wish to let it go. The study of Talmud is a passion. To study is a passion. It is also a celebration of words and their evolution, of a past that refuses to die, of a faith that will not abdicate. You lose all notions of time, distance. Generations meet within the space of a sentence. Centuries are united in one breath, and sages enter into passionate discourse, though they belong to different eras. With the Talmudic dialogue, we live in another time, the time of the eternal present. And to study Talmud is to love it. And to love it is to make it live, as the Talmud makes us live. Such beautiful words about a tradition that incorporates so much of what we still study and learn today. You open volumes of Talmud and you'll find references to literature, jurisprudence, medicine, geometry, geology, astronomy, philosophy, psychology, culture. Everything is in there, and everything that was of interest at the various times in which these debates were taking place was open to be discussed. I'm always amazed as we're learning about various contemporary topics in the Jewish community, how easy it is to go back and find discussions about these things that are already written thousands of years before. Just to clarify, we do have two aspects of Talmud. There's the Yerushalmi Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Babylonian Talmud. And for those who are a little bit familiar with Jewish history, when you hear Jerusalem and Babylon, already some lights will be flashing for you and you'll be thinking, ah, this must have to do with the destruction of the temple. And you're absolutely right. At the time that the temple was destroyed, there was a real fear that all of the knowledge would be lost. And you have a group of Jews who remain in Israel. And interestingly, they're not necessarily in Jerusalem, though it is called the Jerusalem Talmud. And they continue to learn, study, debate, and to record what they're learning. And then you have the Babylonian Talmud, who were the Babylonian exile. So the Jews who are no longer in Israel and who are pining for Jerusalem and are continuing to study and to learn. And that's recorded. For the most part, in terms of the practicalities of Jewish life today, we tend to follow the Babylonian Talmud. That's the one that is referred to the most. But again, like I said, minority opinions are always important. So even when there's a contradiction between the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Babylonian Talmud, we still look to both to learn. And it's interesting because people often look at Judaism and the Jewish people and notice that we have a cultural obsession with questions. It comes into our humor a lot, you know, that the idea of Jews always answering a question with another question. And that's because that is the way the Talmud works. As I said in the quote from Elie Wiesel, you know, you answer one question and you must resolve 10 others that come from the answer. And I think that's also one of the reasons why historically Jews have been so involved in science as well. The whole idea of a hypothesis, of coming with a question and seeking answers, is a very Jewish way of learning. And it's interesting because when you look at the time periods that these people were debating and recording their information, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, these are time periods when it was very dangerous to contradict authority, to ask questions, to disagree with the status quo. And yet you have these examples of incredible Jewish thinkers, some of the most famous Jewish rabbis, whose grandchildren will then disagree and debate with what they've said. And culturally, to disagree or debate with a grandparent is one thing, but also to disagree or debate with a great leader of the time is a big deal. And yet it's expected in Jewish tradition. And we see that throughout our different festivals as well. In a couple of months, we're coming up to the festival of Passover, of Pesach. And interestingly, on the Seder night, one of the climaxes of the evening is the asking of the four questions. And it's four questions about why this night is different from other nights. And the questions are not asked by the elder, the Jewish equivalent of our komatua. The questions are asked by the youngest child at the table who's capable of asking. And those four questions about why tonight is different from other nights is designed to generate curiosity. And I find it so fascinating today. I'm an educator, I work in education, and I find it really interesting when I hear people talking about things like inquiry learning and what a revolutionary and wonderful way this is to educate our young people, to get them interested and to ask questions. And I always have a little chuckle to myself because I think, well, in some ways it's very new and innovative in our education system here in New Zealand and in the postmodern world. But actually, for the other part of my background, my Jewish background, the idea of generating questions from children is something that's been happening for thousands of years and is a very important part of our culture. Another thing that I have to say I love about the Talmud is not only is one permitted to have humour, but it's absolutely encouraged. And very often you'll find examples in the Talmud where the stories will make you laugh, and I'll share one in a moment. But also we have moments of real self-reflection. The authors of the Talmud, I mean, you've got from different time periods, I mean, over 2,000 Amorim, 300 Tanaim, these different sages who have contributed to this body of work. And if you wanted to study the Talmud, even if you just did one page a day, it would take you 7.5 years to finish it. It's a huge, huge volume of work. And very often there are allusions in it to knowledge that the reader is already expected to have. And so it's not just that each page is kind of an easy-to-access, self-explanatory example of learning. Really, to delve into the Talmud means to also delve into Torah and Tanakh, to go back to the five books of Moses, the writings and the prophets. But also, like I said, very often you're delving into topics that are outside of Jewish religious life in many ways, like geometry or jurisprudence, medicine, astronomy, all of these different things. So let me share with you a story that I see humor in, and I love it because it is literally a warts and all story. The story is one of the great rabbis, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya. He was very valued in his time, not just by the Jewish people, but also by those who weren't Jewish, who he lived alongside. And there was a Roman governor at the time who used to refer to him. He really appreciated the wisdom that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya has. And yet the Talmud tells us something about Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya that at first may not seem relevant, but does become so later in the story. As wise as he is, as learned as he is, as great a mind as he has, the rabbi is stereotypically unattractive. And the Talmud doesn't mince words in letting us know. It explains he's an ugly man. And the governor's daughter is completely bewildered by this. She looks at him and sees so much wisdom and such ugliness, and very rudely one day confronts him and asks him, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, how can such beautiful wisdom be housed in such an ugly vessel? Again, the language is amazing. Such an ugly vessel. And the rabbi, in typical Jewish fashion, answers with a question. He says to the governor's daughter, in what vessel does your father keep his wine? She replies, he keeps it in earthenware. The rabbi says, oh, well, that's not fit for a ruler, a leader like your father, to keep wine in earthenware. The governor's daughter says, you're absolutely right. And she orders that every drop of wine be removed from the earthenware and poured into gold and silver goblets and containers. Not surprisingly, the wine turns bad, and the governor is outraged, and he says, well, why is my wine, has it turned bad? And he calls his daughter and says, what have you done? She says, I put your wine into gold and silver as fit for your status. And the governor asks, where did you get that idea from? Why did you do it? And she says, well, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya told me to. The governor is very unimpressed. He summons the rabbi to him and says, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya, why did you tell my daughter to put my wine into gold and silver? And he says, I didn't tell her to put it into gold and silver. I just told her exactly what she told me. And then he explains the story that, you know, how can something so beautiful be held in such an ugly vessel? And he told her exactly, you know, he wanted to teach her. Sorry, he told the governor he wanted to teach her a lesson. And he said, I wanted her to be able to see that wisdom can come in an ugly vessel. And in fact, not only that, but something like wisdom or wine improves if it is placed in an ugly vessel. This the governor cannot take. He turns to Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya and says that that can't be true because there are beautiful people who are also wise. Rabbi Hananya turns to him with a smile and says, yes, but if they were ugly, they would be wiser. An amazing story here. I mean, right from the beginning, this doesn't feel like a story that would be necessarily written in holy books. And yet, the message is as relevant then as it was today. I mean, really, what is the rabbi saying here? Is he saying, in truth, that the uglier someone is, the wiser they will be? No. There are messages in here that are as relevant today around not judging a book by its cover, but also how preoccupation with beauty can interfere in our ability to make other contributions in the world. For anyone who's listening who's ever had a dressing crisis and ended up late to a lecture or a class or an event or work will know what I'm talking about. Our preoccupation with appearance can very often interfere in our ability to be a little bit wiser. And while this story is set back then, and takes place in a completely different time period, one could just as easily bring it into contemporary society and learn the lessons from it as well. To not be preoccupied with appearance and to focus on wisdom and spirituality isn't something that we are just struggling with in today's modern world where we have so much advertising and pressure thrown at us. It was something that was happening throughout time, and we've always had these kinds of challenges. And the Talmud addresses it as a contemporary issue in its time, and yet there's still timeless wisdom of it for today as well. While we still have time together today, I want to take a moment to look at how this body of Jewish teaching and wisdom and thought has ended up being one of the most popular selling books in South Korea. And I had a very interesting experience actually when I, years ago, I was talking to a woman who was over in New Zealand from South Korea for a contract because she was working on an animation project in one of New Zealand's studios. And she said to me, as it came up that I was Jewish, she said to me, oh, you're the first Jew I've ever met. And then she started to talk to me and she said, I really want to know how come all Jews are so smart. And there wasn't a trace of anti-Semitism there. You know, often when there are references like that, it can be in a derogatory way or, some kind of negative message. And I found it really interesting that she had this idea that we were all so smart. And I said, where did you get the idea that all Jews are smart from? Because I could tell there was nothing malicious in her question. And she said, oh, we've studied the Talmud. We studied the Talmud at school. You know, because Jews are so smart. And then she went on to say kind of more of the slurs that you often hear in terms of anti-Semitism, and they're so good at business and they run the media and, you know, they're so talented in science and all of these things, and without a trace of anti-Semitism. And I was fascinated by this because South Korea doesn't have historic anti-Semitism. And as I researched more into it, it's very interesting. The Anti-Defamation League monitors the levels of anti-Semitism around the world. And they'd done a study in South Korea where they'd asked the same questions that they ask everywhere else, some of those kind of touchy topics. And mostly the Koreans had answered in the affirmative. But they saw those things as a positive. You know, if Jews were dominating business, they saw it as a positive thing that they wanted to emulate. You know, if Jews were influential in media, they saw it as a positive thing that they wanted to emulate. So they weren't answering from a place of anti-Semitism. They were answering from a place of admiration. And that kind of can take us a little bit into why there are South Koreans with no connection to Judaism who are studying Talmud on a regular basis. And if you go to South Korea, you can easily pick up copies of the Talmud. They have 8 different publications. It's not exactly the Talmud as we know it, and we'll get into that in a minute. But the fact is, you can go to a regular bookstore and pick up the Talmud. You can even go to kind of a like newsstand and pick up the Talmud because it is so popular. And the drive behind getting the Talmud in Korea has been from Korean mothers who look at the statistics of Jews being overrepresented. For example, you know, that 23% of Nobel Prizes are held by Jews. These kinds of statistics intrigue them. And they look and they say, well, it can't be the 5 books of Moses or the writings and the prophets, because we see other cultures who study and use these books in their religious practices, and we don't see the kind of statistical differences that we're seeing here. So what do the Jews have that other religions don't that has influenced them in this way? And the conclusion that they came to was it must be the Talmud, because that's the text that's unique to the Jewish people. And to understand how you even end up with copies of the Talmud translated into Korean, we have to travel back to America via Japan. So there's a 78-year-old Rabbi Tokaya, who was posted in South Korea and Japan as a chaplain in the U.S. Army in 1962. And he came back to America, met his wife, and although he wasn't Chabad, it was suggested by his friends that he should go visit the Chabad Rebbe and get and invite him to the wedding. And he invited the Rebbe to the wedding, and he couldn't come, but he said, look, bring your bride to me. You come together and I'll give you my blessing. So they went to visit the Rebbe, and with no background knowledge of him, the Rebbe looked at him and he said, you have to go to Japan. Talk to your wife. But there's a huge expat community in Japan and they need a rabbi, and you should go there. The couple were blown away, and they decided that they would go to Japan. And the rabbi moved to Japan, and he was serving the community there. And he was sitting one day in a meeting with a Japanese author, and the author came into the office and sat down, and every few minutes the rabbi was interrupted. Somebody would knock on the door with a question and the rabbi would answer it. Someone would pick up, would call in, and the phone would ring. He'd say, sorry, I just have to get this, and the rabbi would answer it. And there were 5 interruptions on 5 different topics, and the rabbi was able to answer all of them. And the author was completely intrigued. He said to him, how do you have such a breadth of knowledge? How do you, each of these questions are so complex and so technical and about different aspects of Jewish life. How do you know them all? And he said, oh, it's 5,000 years of Jewish wisdom. You know, it's Talmudic scripture. It's our history. You know, I know it because I've studied the Talmud. And the author was hooked. He's like, okay, what is this Talmud? Is there a Korean translation? Is there a Japanese translation of it? And the rabbi said, there's no Japanese translation. And the author said, well, I'm going to talk to my publisher. We need to get one. So this began the journey of the Talmud being translated into Japanese and later into Korean. And what's interesting, though, is when you read the current Korean translations of the Talmud, because it's been translated back into English, it reads like a game of whispers where you've got children in a circle, each one whispering the phrase to the next one, and each time it getting changed slightly. What's more, it's been through publishers, and you know how publishers work, right? They see something and they say, oh, that would be good, but we don't want that bit, or could you change this a little bit? So the Talmud that the Koreans are studying is almost unrecognizable, though it does contain many of the stories, parables, and ways of thinking that the original Talmud did. And from there, the Japanese translation was picked up in South Korea, translated into Korean. And that is how it has become so prolific. And I think it's a very exciting opportunity that we have here, because one of the things that I think always creates more knowledge, more learning, and more interest is when you have different cultures coming together and sharing their learning in new and interesting ways. And we can see this throughout the Talmud. The places in which the sages were in exile influenced the learning that they did as well. And so to have the Talmud being viewed through a South Korean lens also brings new insights and appreciation to old historic learning as well. For those who are interested in studying a little bit more in terms of the Talmud, I want to share with you a story about Einstein. One of the things that Einstein was asked was whether he had any regrets. This was later in his life. And they asked him, you know, towards the end of his life, what would you do differently? And his response was, I would study the Talmud. He regretted not studying Talmud. And I mentioned before that it takes 7.5 years if you do a page a day to study the Talmud. And interestingly, there is a movement called the Daf Yomi, the Daf being page and Yomi being of the day, where you can study the 2.5 million words of the Talmud one page at a time. This movement was started by Rabbi Meir Shapiro in Poland in 1923 and has been going on these cycles of these 7.5 year cycles since then. For better or worse, we're in the middle of a cycle at the moment. So if you start the Daf Yomi, studying a page a day with thousands of Jews and also some people who aren't Jewish as well around the world who study a page a day, you're in Chulin, Masechet Chulin, the tractate of Chulin. And we're about halfway through. But you can pick up anywhere, and it is a kind of a powerful thing to think that what you're studying is being studied around the world. Now, you don't have to learn ancient Aramaic in order to study the Talmud. We live in an amazing day and age where actually if you Google Daf Yomi, D-A-F and then Y-O-M-I, or you Google the concept of studying Talmud a page a day, you get so many different options coming up. One that I use is a 5-minute-a-day summary, just one highlight from each page, 5 minutes a day. It's in English. It's a small audio clip. And it means that each day I'm just taking a snippet, a little something new from the Talmud. And each day there is some kind of lesson or idea or teaching that brings something new into my knowledge base. One of the best things about the Talmud is the fact that it is so eclectic. It brings together disparate ideas. And I think for all of us to be able to learn to think in a more innovative and creative way, if we can draw on this wisdom of taking ideas across space, time, and topic and being able to combine them to take out the wisdom, the humor, and the heart, then we're all going to benefit. Thank you so much for listening today to Radio Shalom. You can tune in online at Planet FM, and I'd like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.